And from the financial crisis to, let's say, the pandemic, $1 trillion of extra balance sheet was created in private credit in the US, and maybe about $500 billion in Europe and Asia. And so today, 43% of the assets in private credit, we think, come from insurance companies. Or put the other way, almost 2/3 of all the new money in private credit in the last 3 years has come from insurers. By having insurers providing the finance, the private credit industry has structurally lowered its cost of capital, and therefore it can be competitive for a far broader range of loans. Now, the interesting question then is that going to be in discretionary wealth? Is it going to be in retirement savings, or is it going to be elsewhere? Well, if you're saving for retirement in 25 years' time, to be stuck in only daily liquidity funds almost seems the wrong thing to do. And in fact, our parents all had access to defined benefit schemes where they could invest 5, 10, 15% in private assets or in gold or in real estate. So in a way, what we're trying to do is almost recreate what our parents had, but in the current format.
Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. If this is your first time joining, I'm your host, Simon Brewer. Quick word before we start. 95% of viewers aren't subscribed, so miss out on future interviews with top business, finance, and industry leaders. To support the show and ensure we can keep sharing high-quality content, click subscribe and please drop a like. Plus, if you have any future guest ideas, do share your suggestions in the comments section below. Otherwise, thank you for watching and listening, and enjoy the show.
When someone speaks with a deep understanding of the banking and finance systems, is widely respected, and then expresses a strong but debatable view about a developing asset class, we think it's important to hear that voice and to challenge and distill its key messages. So today we welcome back a former guest who appeared on the Money Maze podcast in March 2023 during the banking storm in an episode we titled Risk or Opportunity. It was during the deep troubles of Silicon Valley Bank and then Credit Suisse, where his conclusion was unequivocally that this was no repeat of the 2008 Great Financial Crisis, as has indeed proved to be the case. With that, Hugh Van Steenis, Vice Chair of Oliver Wyman, previously Global Head of Banks and Diversified Financials Research for 14 years at Morgan Stanley, and prior to that, the same position at JP Morgan, welcome back to the Money Maze podcast.
Simon, thanks for having me back.
Well, I have noted behind you is a graph that goes classically up and then exponential and then collapses. So before we even start, for those who are watching on YouTube, what's the chart of?
So it's Volmageddon, the inverse volume ETF, which obviously went to zero. My good friend Robin Wigglesworth from the Financial Times gave it to me.
Very good. A former guest indeed himself. So there you go. There's a lesson in that, which isn't today's topic. Now, you and Oliver Wyman have just authored a report entitled Private Credit is Reshaping Wealth Portfolios. And that seems relatively uncontroversial. But I did start thinking to myself, is it that innocuous? Is this a trend which will serve the private asset firms, but maybe at the expense of individuals? How do we think about bad times and souring loans? Does the loss of liquidity matter? Are we swapping risks from the regulated banking sector to the unregulated world of the giant private market firms? And how should we think about fees? So a few of the questions, not exclusively, that we want to address. So I guess that in boxing parlance, in the blue corner, we have Hugh Van Steenis, and in the red, a more cynical investment battle scarred yours truly, who is less convinced of the irresistible investment case. Although I do see how the asset segment may have a very substantial runway ahead for many businesses. So let's start at a high level, Hugh. Banks have always been the lifeblood of economies, and private credit has gone from being $500 billion a decade ago to an estimate by Preqin and the FT it'll be nearly $3 trillion by 2028. Set the scene, please, first. What has been behind this shifting lending behaviours?
I think we've got this in a couple of acts. So I think the sort of the main act we should discuss is post the financial crisis, as we re-regulated banks, we discouraged them from taking riskier loans and, quite frankly, smaller loans. So, for instance, in 2012, the Fed gave guidance on how many leveraged loans a bank could take. That provided a huge opportunity for private credit to pick up those loans which the banks were foregoing. And that was particularly around leveraged finance and mid-market lending. And from the financial crisis to, let's say, the pandemic, $1 trillion of extra balance sheet was created in private credit in the US, and maybe about a half a trillion in Europe and Asia. And so I think that was really a push as the regulators explicitly wanted the banks not to take these risks. What I think you've started to see in the last 5 years, but particularly the last three, is the growing role of insurance assets funding private credit. And of course, insurers have a very different risk appetite. They want to buy higher quality investment grade loans. And so today, 43% of the assets in private credit, we think, come from insurance companies. That's up from 32% 3 years ago. Or put the other way, almost two thirds of all the new money in private credit in the last 3 years has come from insurers. Now, they want investment grade assets. So there's been a pivot, let's call it the next act, which was really to think about originating, loans to hard assets. Could be data centers, could be railroads, could be infrastructure, which are sort of higher quality, lower risk. And I guess what we'll come on to talk about is what's the next act, and that's really talking about wealth. But in that, I think they're clearly, that regulatory push was there. But also, we've seen that having a diversified system is quite frankly good. So going back to the Basel rules, it discourages a bank from taking out to giving a loan much more than 5 years. If you're building a data center, or you're building a new toll road or energy infrastructure, quite frankly, you want money for 8, 10, 15 years. So actually, insurance companies, which have got longer term horizons, actually are quite a natural provider of capital. And so I think what we're really starting to see, and this is something you thought about deeply, is who is the right holder of different types of risk? The more long dated it is, maybe banks aren't the right providers. And the riskier it is, the regulators don't want it to be the banks. So in many ways, this is I think they are symbiotic, but obviously rival us as well.
Okay. Now, we grew up in an era where I used to have the stripy AOBD bond book, and we would look at bonds, and of course you go to the Eurobond market if you were going to issue 5, 10, 30-year debt. Let's just make sure we're all clear on the definition of private credit.
Private credit is an enormous category. And I think that the way I think about it is almost in sort of three big blocks. So it's lending to a mid-market company. So for instance, maybe offering a $75 million loan to a company with a half a billion turnover. The larger banks don't find this such an economic thing to do. And so they've ceded the ground to private credit. Second is leveraged loans. So in other words, providing acquisition finance to the private equity community. And naturally, banks still provide that, but it's a natural asset for private credit because they know these companies well and they know the sponsors. And then a third bucket is asset-backed lending. So providing finance where the collateral, the backing is a hard asset, as data center, energy infrastructure, and so on. And so we've almost got going from, higher risk, non-investment grade, to cuspy investment grade, to firmly investment grade. And so I think you've now, it's a much more heterogeneous space. And so it's very difficult for me to say that define in one word, what is private credit? For the assets which go to insurers, they are all rated. Now, sometimes it's the bonds themselves, the loans themselves are rated, or the loans are packaged up, put into a securitization, and then the securitization is rated. But one way or another, the insurers do need a degree of credit rating. And so there's also a really interesting subplot here, how the credit rating agencies are spending a far greater time actually helping private credit, work out the standards and actually the credit quality.
Okay, and we're going to come back to that. So I understand the buyer profile, and we're going to talk about the wealth channel in a minute. But let's just flip it to the issuer, because if I've got my data right, Meta just issued a record-breaking $29 billion private credit deal to fund massive expansion into AI. And just take me to the mind of the FD and the board of a Meta. What is it that they find attractive about this route?
I don't want to talk about that one specific company, but what I think you're finding is the private credit firms are not just competing with banks, they are competing with the investment grade bond market and the securitization market. So it's a slightly different battlefront, and I think that's maybe underestimated by certainly much of the media. So what would be different is the investment grade bond market is fantastic for vanilla bonds. I want 5-year bonds, 8-year bonds, I'm a high quality company. But when it's a complex deal, when it's a jumbo deal, or when it's very long dated, maybe sometimes the investment grade bond market isn't such a good place. And so what you're finding with many of these data center AI buildouts, where the sponsor, if you like, or the backer is actually a very high quality, you know, large tech company, they're looking for a broader range of pools of capital, and private credit is becoming increasingly compelling as a provider of finance. And I think, Simon, in a way, it goes back to the conversation about the insurers. In a way, I think sometimes what you're very good at is thinking about what are the longer term trends here. By having insurers providing the finance, the private credit industry has structurally lowered its cost of capital, and therefore it can be competitive for a far broader range of loans than it could do when it was offering a 12% loan to a private equity backed acquisition. So I think that structural trend is why we're starting to see this blossoming of very large complex deals play out for the big tech firms.
So before we continue this conversation, we're going to take a short break to have a note from our sponsors. IFM Investors is a global asset manager, founded and owned by pension funds with capabilities in infrastructure equity and debt, private equity, private credit, and listed equities. They believe healthy returns depend on healthy economic, environmental, and social systems, and these are evolving on a scale never experienced before. To find opportunity, build value, and meet the needs of future generations, you need scale, skill, and expertise. That's what IFM Investors has built up over 30 years. In times of economic and geopolitical volatility, investors will look to gold. Today, as the world navigates uncertainty and heightened risk, investors of all sorts will look to safeguard their wealth. We're thrilled to welcome the World Gold Council as one of our sponsors. Tap the link in the show notes to learn more, or visit goldhub.org on your browser for comprehensive research, insights, and analysis on the global gold market.
Okay, clearly expressed. I absolutely get that insurance piece. As we think about the wealth universe, very different, both because of the emotional mercurialism, time horizons which change given bull or bear market. And would it be fair to say that a lot of this individual appetite really started, you know, at the time when there was a search for yield during the zero rate era?
So I think that the zero interest rate environment clearly called for an interest for many investors. But I think the growth in wealth really has really popped up in the last sort of 5 years. And I think that, again, thinking big picture, this is started with the most sophisticated and largest pools of capital, you know, family offices, the extraordinarily wealthy. And then it started to come to the very wealthy. And I think the real innovation at the moment is, can this then be offered to the mass affluent or accredited investors, particularly in the States, who would like to, quite frankly, have the options that an institutional investor can access? So we think there's something like 12% of the assets of the major private market firms are now coming from the wealthy. That's up from 8%, you know, 3 years ago. You know, put it the other way around, money from the wealthy is growing four times faster than from a classic institutional channel. And we think that the probably 80-85% of that is from the spectacularly wealthy, but it's starting to grow. And I think the really interesting thing, Simon, is then the development of, or basically fund innovation. The combination of technology, affording access and simplifying the document process, and innovation on the funds is allowing a sort of democratization of access through evergreen funds. So in other words, rather than putting your money away for 12 years, it's actually saying from day one, you can start to put it into an existing pool of assets. And that development of the evergreen area is probably the single fastest growing part of the investment industry this year. We estimate in the States, evergreen funds in the first half have grown annualized 60%. And so I think this is an area where there's a lot of, we can talk a bit more about how you structure it, but that's really the real focus for the industry.
And do you see sort of something of an irony, maybe it's a cynical irony, that the very time that Yale, where championed by David Swensen with his brilliant approach to portfolio management, looking for that illiquidity premium, at the very time that Yale has announced it's substantially reducing its commitment to private equity and other private assets, the slack's being taken up by the individual world, who in at large, and maybe that's more retail, that perhaps has a habit of coming to the game late?
So I think it's a bit more nuanced than that, Simon. So obviously the US universities have got a number of issues. And I always think in finance, it's never one thing. It's the combination of two or three thumps at the same time. And so obviously the response to the anti-Semitism on campus and so forth, obviously there's a series of issues which are leading to the universities to need to call cash. The second thing, at least the report we were focusing on in this case, was around credit. And I think that you know that since we had the biggest increase in interest rates for 45 years, it has had a profound way on thinking about what is the right asset allocation for an endowment, for an individual. And if, like, in a way, fixed income is back. And actually, the last 3 years, many people had not really thought a lot about fixed income and are now really rethinking. And so if you look at it, what I'm really struck by the endowments, and you spend a lot of time engaging with them, is they have very, very little in private credit. Almost all their private exposure is actually real estate and private equity and venture capital. Actually, private credit is peanuts. I mean, if I give you a statistic, let's go even not just the US endowments. Take the Aussie Super Fund, which I agree with Mark Groen. I think the Australian superannuation system is the best system in the world. They've got about 15 to 20% in private assets, but the largest fund has only got 2% in private credit. So actually the credit piece is, I think, in a very different category. Now, when you come to retail, you know, I think we need to think about, are these going to be in, you know, diverse? What's the right structure to make sure that if you're investing in a liquid asset, that both the client has got the option to get out, but it's actually, but you're managing the asset liabilities really well. And so I think it's interesting to me that the majority of the money in the last few years has come through business development corporations, which are like an investment trust. And so they are sort of closed end vehicles. The innovation at the moment are through interval funds, which have got quarterly liquidity, typically up to 5%. And look, you know, there's one fund out there which is 60% public bonds, 40% private bonds. Well, there's an awful lot needs to go wrong before you can't sell. You know, you start to have liquidity issues. There's another new fund which I'm quite intrigued by, which has got about half-half between public securitizations and private securitizations. So look, you know, as with any wave of innovation, there'll be things, lessons learned. But I think at the moment, the fund innovation looks quite responsible and quite well thought through to address the potential asset liability mismatches.
Well, I'm sort of going to ring the bell using our boxing analogy for a pause, because before we get to those risks, of which I think there are a few specific ones I want to address, just staying high level, because you have quite rightly pointed out over the last few years, there's been a shift in the approach to fixed income investing, and you have dubbed it, you and others, but the barbell approach. You've written about it, and you say it's a smart evolution in fixed income thinking. So because this is part of the jigsaw, just give us your minute or so on how that thinking and why that thinking has evolved.
Well, so if I think about it, so when I was back at Morgan Stanley, just over 20 years ago, we coined this term, the asset management barbell, to describe the polarization of portfolios. And back then we were thinking between index funds and the nascent ETF industry. So in other words, cheap, reliable ways to get access to broad market indices. So cheap. And at the other end, spicy, you know, looking for higher risk return allocations, could be hedge funds, could be private assets, could be private credit. And that polarization has probably been one of the defining trends for investing in equities. And we all know the success of BlackRock and Vanguard, State Street and others, really benefiting from that. And I guess that, you know, I wasn't really in the market to sort of dust off an old concept from 20 years ago. But when I looked at that interest rate shock, it really made me think, actually, what we're now starting to see is that barbelling of portfolios is coming in earnest to fixed income. And just to give you a statistic, just 6 years ago, 15% of the US retail industry in fixed income funds, so in other words, mutual funds and ETFs, 15% was in index and ETFs. As of last month, it's now 30%. So there's been a doubling at the cheap and cheerful end. And what we're starting to see is clients looking also to put it into more interesting slices of risk. Now, for the very wealthy and for the accredited investors, so in other words, ones who have got a degree of wealth and are sophisticated, they can put their money to work in private credit. And as I said, we've seen a 2.5-fold increase in assets in the last 3 years. But that, what my thesis from here is that this barbelling has got another decade to run, if not 2 decades to run, on the fixed income side. And so that's why I start to think about the role of private credit potentially in mass affluent portfolios. Now, the interesting question then is that going to be in discretionary wealth? Is it going to be in retirement savings, or is it going to be elsewhere? And I think there are going to be very different pockets. But the real interest, of course, is there's $12 trillion in retirement savings. At the moment, allocations to private assets are close to zero. Well, if you're saving for retirement in 25 years' time, to be stuck in only daily liquidity funds almost seems the wrong thing to do. And in fact, our parents all had access to defined benefit schemes where they could invest 5, 10, 15% in private assets or in gold or in real estate. So in a way, what we're trying to do is almost recreate what our parents had, but in the current format. So in other words, I don't view it quite in such a scary way, but I think this. But obviously we need to do it in a very responsible way and make sure that the conduct regulators, the SECs and others, you know, really understand the issues and can help the industry develop in a thoughtful way.
So whilst we all know that passive investing in equity has been largely proven to be right, given the difficulty of outperforming these indices, the really interesting thing, which slightly sits sort of on the other side of your position, is that whether it was Manny Roman from PIMCO or Greg Peters from PGIM, the evidence is there is still quite a lot of alpha to be achieved in the world of fixed income, unlike the world of equity. So a world that's pivoting to passive, you know, increasingly, does make you think, well, is that the smart thing? And you and I both sit on, you know, investment committees. How have you processed that?
Well, look, I think it's a very good challenge. So look, I think let's go down one bunny hole. What's really interesting to me is that the pandemic actually turbocharged the growth of ETFs in fixed income. And that's because as all of us were at home, and particularly the traders were at home, the liquidity in the bond markets actually pivoted very quickly towards ETFs. So the primary way to have liquidity in the bond market is now ETFs rather than underlying bonds, which is a dramatic change. And as everyone went back to the office, they kept with that convention. So I think the liquidity of the fixed income market has surprised all the naysayers, you know, and particularly all the central bankers who are a little bit worried about ETFs as a fixed income construct. But your point really is then, how do you get the plus plus? So in other words, if you've got your core holdings cheaply, how do you get the core plus, or what I've been dubbing in the latest note, core plus plus? So in other words, you're trying to get access to private credit too. Now, one way is you do it as a slice on its own. And I think for the very wealthy, that makes perfectly good sense. And whether it's an evergreen fund or a J-curve fund, you know, that's obviously then depend on the suitability for the client. But what we're starting to see, though, is the role of credit plus plus in a broader portfolio. And I think this year you've got a lot of innovation around that. And again, maybe doing a longer term sweep and thinking about your great interview with Manny. Well, actually, if you think about what PIMCO did 25 years ago with their total return bond fund, one of the ways that they outperformed the index was they started to use derivatives. And back then, that was completely novel, and really people weren't using derivatives. A couple of years later, the SEC then gave guidance on how to use derivatives in a classic mutual fund structure. Now it's business as usual. And so I think in a way, one of the possible subplots here, as we start to see a blurring of lines between public and private bonds, actually, I wouldn't be surprised if popping in some private credit and a portfolio will be very much like the derivatives of 25 years ago. And also, as you remember, Simon, from your time long Stanley, the derivative guys took over the cash equities business because actually they came with new tools. And I think that's the other interesting play here is we're starting to see a mushrooming of partnerships between private firms and traditional long-only firms, partly because the private firms don't have access to 300,000 independent advisors in the States, let alone many tens of millions of clients. And so I think there's also a potential story here about what does this do to the structure of the traditional asset management industry. And I think that's something which we'd like to come back to time and time again over the next 5 years. So I think it's a very profound change.
Okay. And before we leave this, you alluded to, and I think it's worth just coming back to the role that technology is playing in facilitating the, you know, the dicing and slicing of asset pools, suddenly making it more accessible for individuals. Just comment on what that is, because pipes are being built by firms you and I know that is, you know, is important new infrastructure.
Oh, no, I think it's great. I think that tech is one of the three key enablers of this trend now, but it's everywhere. So it's what are the right platforms on which to place assets? Companies such as iCapital, again, I'm not trying to pick on one, but as an example, who are providing a platform and access. We are starting to see the ratings agencies start to think about their role in the private market. Index funds are thinking about the role about can they create indices and benchmarks so that risk can be assessed and the portfolios can be assessed for individual clients. And again, technology is enabling to do that at smaller clip sizes than for institutional investors. Documentation. I mean, as you know, signing up for private investments is typically very heavy on signatures and paperwork. And so there's a whole element of work to try and simplify the process. We're also starting to see even some tokenization. I hate to bring that word up here, but there are starting to see the folk to try and simplify the process. And the other element, of course, is how to engage with these 300,000 registered investment advisors in the States. Well, another innovation is many of the largest asset managers are creating online universities to help educate and think through a different type of portfolio. And so actually technology is everywhere. I mean, I think it's enabling access, the underlying platform of the business, and also slicing the assets into smaller pieces. And maybe if I give you one other piece, I think the other element here is that the more clients you have, the more complex the cash flows. And so we're also seeing that the major private asset firms are really doing a major upgrade of their treasury management, so cash in, cash out, and how they think about that, and their technology platforms, because they themselves are going to be dealing with a level of complexity they didn't have to do when they had 150 clients and each loan portfolio was maybe only 30 names. It's a very different level of complexity. And so we're also seeing the technology adoption by the major private market firms, you know, really have a step change as well.
Okay, so you have set the stage for the demand side and the supply side and the enablers very clearly. I want to come back to the risks. I'm reminded of the late, great Paul Volcker, who said that the greatest financial innovation of the previous 30 years had been the cash machine. And to go back even further, Voltaire, although he said it in French, I imagine, not English, said history never repeats itself, but man always does. Now, history is littered with poor lending episodes culminating in rescues, typically of the banks. And I happened to be listening to Jeffrey Gundlach this morning, who had just spoken, and he said private credit is analogous to the CDO market in the run-up to the great financial crisis. There's been tremendous acceptance, tremendous issuance, and lots of the similar phraseology. Now, disintermediation doesn't eliminate risk. It shifts it to other lenders, some of whom, I think it could be argued, haven't been in that game for as long. So just help me understand how you've got comfortable with the risk practices in the new lending community.
Okay, so it's a great set of questions. So let's try to unpack it a couple of things. So the first is, do I perceive systemic risk in private credit? And my answer to that, and I've written about this, is no. And the reason is not, it's not to say that there may not be risks in individual loans. Like everything in life, there'll be some good decisions and some bad decisions. What's really interesting to me as well is, what are the consequences when you're wrong? And obviously in the financial crisis, there were profound consequences, a once in a 70-year shock as a result of that first bank run in the UK since 1866. I mean, these were profound consequences. Here though, if I think about, let's imagine a loan is going from a bank to a private credit fund. Well, you're going from an institution which is typically 10 times levered to one which may be 0 to 1 times levered if it's an institutional portfolio. Maybe if it's an insurance portfolio, it's 5 to 6 times levered. But there's less leverage as the loan passes from a bank to a non-bank. I think second is duration. Now, at the moment, as I said, almost half the assets come from insurers. which have got maybe a horizon of 12 years. Well, again, so they've got the duration. And the third is then interconnectedness. So what happens if you trip up? Well, if a bank trips up, it's holding your deposits. And that has profound implications. And let's be clear, when you very kindly last had me on the show, 2 years ago, the entire US deposit base got guaranteed. Let's repeat, the entire deposit guarantee base of the States got guaranteed because of a couple of banks reaching to the top shelf and tripping over. Well, in that time, private credit ended up in that year, 2023, providing 85% of the lending to the mid-market to the mid-market leveraged finance market. So in other words, they carried on lending. Admittedly, there weren't so many deals that year when the banks were really on their back foot. So I think there's much less. I think it's not just in theory. We have had a profound stress test in 23, and private credit traded through it very well. So I think systemic risk is poor, is not there. Second, though, where I think there are going to be issues which need to be worked through are, you know, what happens if a loan goes sour? There will be plenty of bad decisions because that's life. And so I think the major firms will need to have teams to think about, doing workouts. And that's one area where banks are very good. And I think that's an area for greater infill. And I think second, as you posed it, Simon, is, you know, if you are going to put illiquid assets into retail portfolios, being very thoughtful and consequential about the asset liability mismatch and what to do and how to stress test it, this is going to be incredibly important. And so I suspect when we think about the executive order, which may potentially be coming from the president soon, how the SEC and Department of Labor think about the guidance of what is an appropriate structure. And I think that's going to be the area where we are going to be very thoughtful about things going forward. And then last point, pricing conventions. If assets at the moment are marked to market once every 3 months, we probably will need to update those conventions to be every month, every couple of weeks. So I think there's lots of innovation and work to be done, but I just don't worry that it's a systemic risk in some way that some do.
Schroders is a leading provider of active asset management, advisory and wealth management services, recognised as a leader in sustainability. Few investment managers can match the combination of capabilities and global reach that Schroders offer. Across public and private markets, Schroders offers distinctive investment solutions for the diverse needs of wealth, pension and insurance clients, and the other owners of long-term assets, providing excellent long-term investment outcomes when Schroders succeeds for clients, society and the wider world benefit too. The Money Maze podcast is proudly sponsored by the London Stock Exchange Group, a global leader in financial markets infrastructure. LSEG has a rich history of facilitating capital flows, empowering businesses and connecting investors to opportunities. Today, they provide world-class technology, data and analytics, playing a critical role in shaping modern finance. From their role in sustainable investing to their contributions to financial innovation, LSEG is helping to build more connected and efficient markets. Visit LSEG.com via the link in the show notes to see how they're driving the future of finance.
Okay, there was a technical question from our former colleague. Always good to have a smart Kiwi come in. The question, Mike Weston said, what percentage of private credit is secured?
So in terms of then secured or into hard assets, it's a great question. So well, let's just go back to it. If 43% of the assets for the top leading firms come from insurers, the vast majority of that is going to be investment grade assets secured by something. So I think you're going to get somewhere between 40 to 50% probably. But let's be clear, with the leverage loans and the mid-market loans, there's also sometimes a tie on collateral as well. But it's going to be about half.
Okay. So you're taking a balanced, I would say, you know, it's an optimistic view with some caveats. We were lucky enough to have Howard Marks on, you know, a few months back. What an honor, I have to say, and what a terrific interview, what a guest he was. You know, his adage, the worst of loans are made in the best of times. And we have been living in times where finance was cheap and where, you know, we've seen this growth on the back of a number of the things that we've discussed. And so the counterweights are people you know well. Singapore's GIC has been out there with concerns around non-bank lending. due to a number of things in one of their recent reports, and they see obviously over 800 billion, and they say in hindsight, we haven't really seen a major credit default cycle yet. I think Jamie Dimon was out there saying, I quote him, or I quote the article, which is, I've seen a couple of these deals that have been rated by a ratings agency, and I have to confess, it shocked me how they got rated. And it allegedly went on to say, when the shit hits the fan, and it will be one day, we don't know when, there'll be a lot of stranded borrowers. And you and I know that credit behaves like equity in the really ugly times. I think it was back to Gundlach, he said, this stuff will drop 30 points. So when one is modelling, and you and I back to, you know, sitting there making asset allocation decisions, come back thinking about risk and return. So let me ask you a question, which is, what do you think is the right premium, by which I mean, you know, the return over a equivalent government bond that makes sense to enter into this space with a, you know, with a sensible commitment?
So it's a very good question. So let's think about, for a large institutional investor, at the moment, the sort of the pitch would be that an insurance company can get roughly a 1.5% premium owning a single A bond, so an investment grade bond, in the private market over the public market. Now, clearly there's a range around that, but that's a sort of premium. And therefore, the insurers, institutional investors are viewing that that's a risk that they're prepared to wear. And I think also, when we think about I think the private equity market is somewhat different in that the liquidity of the public bond market, as you discussed with Manny, has deteriorated materially. And so actually, there's a much more grey scale between public bonds and private bonds than there is between public equities, which are very liquid, and private equity, which is very illiquid. So I think it's a slightly different story on the credit side. So 1.5 points, obviously, on the equity side, investors are hoping for more like 4 to 5, if not more. So I think that that's the sort of risk which profile they're looking for. But I think, Simon, you're asking, is that well compensated? And I think there's a market call and there's a specific asset. And I think it's right to say that, you know, we haven't seen a big cycle. We did see some losses, let's be clear, in the pandemic, some cyclical assets, you know, some hotels, some retail businesses, some holiday businesses did have to restructure their debts. And in fact, in Europe, some of the energy companies had to restructure their debts. So it's not that we didn't see a cycle, but it was wasn't quite as broad and deep given the extraordinary fiscal support from the state. I think it has been very striking and surprised everyone, including pretty much every bank CFO and CEO I know, has been surprised that the biggest interest rate shock for 45 years hardly had an impact on the creditworthiness and the spreads of the major market indices and also the private bonds. But that's not to say there won't be some issues. I mean, let's be clear. Credit, you know, I think as a banks analyst, I'm always like a credit analyst in an equity envelope in my old role. And I think that you get paid to worry. And so it's likely there will be some decisions which now with 2020 hindsight look wrong. But, you know, that's part of life. The question is, are you getting compensated for that? And are you buying the right price rather than whether it's imprudent to take risk at all?
I went away to try and glean better quality data on long-term returns. And Cambridge Associates, who are, you know, I know through one of the investment roles I have, do have some 25-year data, which shows normal returns at 9.1%. But actually, interestingly, the 1 and 3 year data is down at 7%. And inevitably, data about an emerging asset class is, you know, is highly flawed. So that's on one hand, there is an argument that returns stack up to justify it, albeit that it has those caveats. The other thing, a little bit, which is more difficult, is how to benchmark performance. We all know in the equity world, that's straightforward, and in the playing game, you know, when you are thinking about this and discussing it, how should one approach the issue of, you know, judging performance of private loan portfolios?
It's a great question. So look, first things first, the major index companies are spending an awful lot of time thinking about their role in this ecosystem. And every single one of them is wanting to have a play, because I think you're right, Simon, as like with any major wave of growth, there's a maturation and there will be need to be more benchmarks, quite frankly, just for risk management, let alone for just performance attribution. So I think this is an area where there's an awful lot going on in terms of R&D. But if you're sitting there as the CIO of an insurance company or the CIO of a pool of assets, you obviously want to, you know, ensure that you not only get a good yield, running yield, but you get your money back. And so in some ways, you won't know until the five-year loan or whatever, or the, you know, the loan has actually matured. But at least with credit, remember, you are getting paid down each and every year. Now, there are some troubled borrowers who are doing payment in kind, so in other words, rolling up the interest. But on the whole, you can start to see that across the portfolio. So, you know, take some of the insurance companies, some of the leading firms in the US now having, you know, high, mid to high teens in private credit, and they've got themselves comfortable that the risk-adjusted returns are appropriate for annuity holders. And let's be clear, the policy holders have benefited from higher returns as well so far. But, you know, it's like, I think in everything in life, with private markets, one also needs to think about the vintage. I mean, actually, the vintage of lending, let's say since I was last on 2 years ago, actually 2023 was a cracking vintage because spreads were wider, the banks weren't lending. It was a phenomenal opportunity set for private credit. Given things are very tight this year, maybe it's not such a good vintage. And I think we just need to be thoughtful about the cycle and the fact that, you know, where spreads are compressed.
Yeah, and I'll speak for myself. In, you know, my allocation, a lot of an allocation to short-term UK gilts that are tax efficient, nothing in the credit space because I'm waiting for the next downturn. Maybe I have to wait longer than I'd like, but that will come. But the bit before we leave, because I don't want to dominate the conversation with the risk because there's some other important things, but the world of private equity and private credit has become increasingly intertwined because of the loans that are taking place to support some of the businesses sitting in the portfolios. There's some opacity. Moody's has, you know, specifically commented on some of those risks. Are we, and I think earlier on you talked about the reduction, specifically reduction in places like Yale in their private equity component as opposed to their private credit portfolios. But do you think there's been a little bit of blurring of the lines that these some of these private equity firms have, you know, have taken advantage of their ability to draw down loans to be able to finance these businesses?
I think there's a couple of questions in there. So I think first, like we were discussing earlier, Simon, the space is now very broad and deep. And so it's very difficult to say what is a private credit loan. And so what you're seeing is, a private credit loan could be an alternative to an investment grade bond. It could be an alternative to securitization. It could be an alternative to a non-bank lender. So in other words, financing a car, you know, which the car companies historically have offered, through to, of course, leveraged loans or mid-market loans. And so it's a very broad and deep spectrum. You know, within that, you know, I think if you talk to many investors, the leveraged loan space, there has been, the M&A cycle has been a bit softer of late. The banks and private credit all wanted to be competitive. So, of course, spreads have got very compressed. And as, you know, Howard Marks, you know, likes to say, the price you pay is critical for the return you get. So that compression of spreads. But what I'm seeing and the conversations we're having is that this industry is really broadening out. And so if there is a loan to a data center, well, you know, we can take a view about whether DeepSeek is a real threat. There's a, you know, and so forth. So there's some really interesting micro issues for that space. But actually, that space looks like it's booming and needs enormous amount of funding. We've also got energy infrastructure, particularly in Europe, where we need to backfill for some of the, let's call it the very messy energy transition we're going through, requires a traditional and clean energy infrastructure for many years to come. And then we've also got the role of defense and other areas. So you've got a very broad credit palette to play with. And so certain colors on the palette look maybe quite tight. Other colors look quite interesting. And so I think also for an asset allocator, there's going to be a much greater sophistication about where you place your bets across the private credit landscape.
Okay, that's well argued. Now I'm going to shift tack to a couple of wider questions. This is definitely going to be quickly beyond my pay grade, but I see, and this may be being by championed by Scott Bessent, who was a guest when we got to know him, he was Treasury Secretary, that the regulators are looking at a proposed change to the enhanced supplementary leverage ratio for large banks, which in my terms seems to mean that treasury bonds, etc., will be given better treatment, which will make banks capable of lending more or doing other things. How does a pro like you read it?
So look, Simon, what was fascinating is last week there was the first ever Fed with all the other agencies conference on recalibrating bank capital. And for the financial nerds, this was an extraordinary session and actually had some amazing disclosures, including one bank CEO, I think almost inadvertently, suggesting that one major bank was at risk in 2023. So, but I think the thing about it is it's not just about the leverage ratio. This is about recalibrating many different technical areas to help credit flow. So I think there's going to be the surcharge for being one of the giant banks is being looked afresh at. The stress tests and the level of transparency is being looked at afresh. So you've got, it's almost like, think about this like your heating system at one's home. Every different part of the heating, every valve is being tweaked. Now, what could that add up to? The kind of the range I'm thinking of, or we're thinking of, I should say, is between a 5% to maybe at the tops 15% reduction in the capital for the major US banks. Now, let's be clear, this isn't the mid one, size ones, which were in trouble 2 years ago. This is for the top, 12 or so. And so let's take the midpoint of that. If it ends up, if it were to be closer to 10%, well, that would mean their structurally, their cost of funds would become a bit cheaper. They could lend a bit more. They could certainly buy some more government bonds. But it's not, again, black and white. It's a recalibration. And to be honest, I suspect over time we'll also see a recalibration in Europe too, because we need, at the end of the day, credit only comes from two forms. It either comes from banks or from investors. And if you want to finance the growth and the extraordinary capital capex needs of the tech revolution or the energy transition and so forth, you need the private sector to help. So I think we're like to see recalibration actually on banks, but also for investors too. And that's the way I think about potentially private assets into retirement savings in the States, or changing tax slightly. There's been a major change in Europe where for the first time since the financial crisis, the EU will allow securitizations to be thought of as not quite so risky. So I think we're actually seeing a major change across global regulators to recalibrate. And again, the headlines say it's black and white. It's not. These are about shifting the valves to help finance flow.
Okay, different question that's been quite remiss of me. There you are, Vice Chair of Oliver Wyman. How does Oliver Wyman and your role lend itself to what's going on in terms of your capabilities and skills and help?
I'm not really here to pitch, but let's say I think the firm has got, really good green fingers in the technical understanding of how banks, insurers, asset owners, private market firms operate. And so in an era where lots and lots of valves are being tweaked, I hope our green fingers can be of value to our clients.
And the light behind the Money Maze podcast, Will Campion, had a question for you, which is, what do you most enjoy about your job?
Oh, gosh, great question. I think it's the same red thread through my time at JP Morgan and Morgan Stanley. And to be honest, even advising the former governor of the Bank of England, Mark Carney, is that it's about trying to think about investment problems, understand the trends, and really provide good advice on investment or strategic questions, and trying to get an edge to help people make smarter and better decisions.
And before I sum up, you are obviously in great demand everywhere. I know you appear at Davos. The cynics would say there are a lot of people who are extremely pleased with themselves who pitch up at Davos. What do you think it's like when you're inside the ropes?
The answer that many people give to the Davos question is, it's a very efficient speed dating for 3 days with people from all over the world. And I think that continues to be the case. I've nearly always spent my time really engaging with investors and financial institutions and trying to pick up what the mood is. Whether it's Davos or quite frankly Milken, which I think is a fantastic conference, it's a very efficient way to pick up the market consensus and where the debate is. All the other bits for agenda, I think we could talk about another time.
Okay, well, it would be remiss not to say that you are very kindly have agreed to chair the credit panel at the Money Maze Allocator Summit, which is, as you know, something that we hope will become a feature of the investing landscape, this year and beyond. So we're very grateful for that. So if I try to draw this together, you have very clearly articulated these changing dynamics in both the provision of and the purchase of credit, the multiple players, the different industries that are represented, and the dangers in being too black and white, as I might be sometimes. From my own perspective, a friend in advance of this said, I got called by my private banker and he said, you've got to move money into this private credit fund. It's, you know, it's one of the great things. And he and I chuckled because, you know, that's a typical line that often comes from, you know, private banks. And I know them quite well, often at the wrong times in the cycle. So I suspect that from my perspective, and I'm not an insurance company, which is a very different timeline, there are going to be better opportunities to allocating capital to this space, and dislocations absolutely come along as night follows day. And it was Howard Marx's sea change memo that talked about this. I also worry that just as private equity suffers from what Cliff Asness dubs the volatility laundering, you did allude to the fact pricing schedules or timelines will have to be changed. But, you know, if you're not marking something to the market as regularly or as accurately as you might, it looks great. You get a better Sharpe ratio. You know, people around the investment committee feel sort of sometimes quite pleased. But that isn't always reflective of the underliking because, as a recent guest said, the only thing you can't renegotiate in a deal is your entry price. So Hugh, I really appreciate you spending time today, and this report for, you know, which we will make available, is highly thoughtful, full of data. It's a really good piece of research, and one can, and we hope that our listeners who are allocators from all over the world will be going through their own process, and this hopefully will, you know, help their debate and their internalization. So thank you for taking so much time today to come and talk to us.
Thank you very much, Simon, for having me on.
All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only, and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.